Good morning and welcome. Oh, I'm in between two microphones. Good morning. Welcome to the January 12th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And I want to just explain for people in the audience that at the moment we are, as you see, a committee administrator, very capable, and two capable committee members. We do not at the moment have a quorum, so we will be being joined by the Senate President approximately 9:30 for the purpose of bill introductions. So I am going to start off, obviously you have the agenda in front of you, and we're going to go pretty much in the order that we're on the agenda. I'm going to start by opening a work session for the purpose of taking testimony on LC 26, and I will ask Teresa to tell us what LC 26 is very briefly, and at the same time, if the Employment Department could come forward, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. LC 26 modifies the definition of emergency benefit period for purposes of unemployment insurance benefits to begin on the first week that begins at least 14 days after the effective date of the concept and ending when the total of the Oregon emergency benefits paid reaches $19 million. The concept also adjusts the maximum Oregon emergency benefits an individual can receive under the concept to 23% of the individual's most recent regular unemployment benefit claim. The concept also authorizes the department to adopt rules that provide for eligibility period for purposes of extended benefits if the federal legislation provides for greater than 50% funding of extended benefits. There is an emergency clause on this concept effective upon passage.
Thank you very much, Teresa, and thank you. I see Director Lori Warner and Tom Byerly, head of the Unemployment Insurance Division here, and we really appreciate you being here, and I think as people are looking at LC 26, they will see that it has today's date on it. So it is practically still warm in our hands, and this is a concept that I know has been in development over a period of some time. So we understand that you're looking at the bill and describing the concept at the same time. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Director of the Employment Department, and with me is Tom Byerly, the Unemployment Insurance Division Administrator. The first slide here is just to remind you this is the tax schedule history and that we are in tax schedule 6 for 2010, which is what we talked to the legislature about when you were in session. That's what we projected. We do expect to be in tax schedule 11, tax schedule 8 in 2011 through 2014. And there's nothing in this LC that will change these projections for tax schedules. So just a reminder about that. The next slide, this is the current UI benefit programs, and you've seen this before, the regular benefits of 26 weeks, the emergency unemployment compensation of 53 weeks, House Bill 3326 at the federal level passed that extended emergency unemployment compensation. This is what we were waiting for to February 28th from December 31st. And claimants can claim through from May 31st to July 31st. There are no more weeks that were added. They just extended the dates that you can be eligible for emergency unemployment compensation. That is important to us because they get more weeks of federal benefits. The next is the extended benefit program of 20 weeks, and then the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program Part 1. And you'll remember that you passed this last session. You authorized us to spend $30 million on this program, and it ended on January 2nd, 2010. We have spent, of the $30 million, we've spent $11 on this program. And we have $19 million that is unexpended from the Oregon Emergency Benefits, and largely because of the fact that the federal government extended their programs, people qualified for more weeks of the federal benefit weeks, and we didn't have to pay as much out of Oregon emergency benefits. There were still 1,900 Oregonians who didn't qualify for any additional federal weeks, even under the extension, and so those are the folks that have benefited the most from the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program. So with that, the other thing is the characteristics of the people on Oregon Emergency Benefits are that they're about 50% men and about 50% women, slightly more women than men. Most of the folks on Oregon Emergency Benefits have a high school education or less, and they predominantly have been working in retail or food service or clerical type of occupations, because we ran kind of a characteristics of those claimants so that you'd have an idea of who we're serving under that program currently. So with that, the next slide here, a few slides Tom's going to talk about, and then we'll talk about the bill.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator of the Unemployment Insurance Division for the Employment Department. What we're showing here on this slide is our initial claims, our new claims for all programs, and this is based on our December 2009 forecast. You can see that we had a pretty significant spike there in last winter, beginning of 2009, and it's slowly come down, and we are now in another spike up for the first of 2010. And I just want to make sure that everybody's clear that just because that number is going down doesn't necessarily mean that our economy has totally turned around and that lots of people are going back to work. Some are going back to work, but I think it's an indicator that a lot of people don't have eligibility. They've been out of work for a long period of time, so their eligibility is simply running out. So that's new claims. This chart shows the weekly claims. To be eligible for an unemployment insurance benefit payment, you need to claim each week that you're available and actively seeking work. You can see that this has been on a pretty steady increase since the late summer of 2008, where it just went practically straight up. We've showed this slide in this committee before. We expect it to go up again just a little bit more in the first part of 2010 before it starts tailing off. And again, not so much for people going back to work, although we do anticipate some jobs coming in spring. It's more of a function of people running out of benefits. Okay, to the concept, legislative concept number 26. What this does, what this concept will do, is expand the former or current, I guess, Oregon Emergency Benefit Program that the legislature passed in 2009. You'll see that there's $19 million left that was accounted for out of the $30 million that was of the prior bill. This bill would pay up to 6 weeks of emergency benefits to eligible workers. It's the claim of last resort. There will be no other benefits after this claim. These benefits come after all the federal program eligibility has been exhausted, the ones that we showed earlier. Another part of this concept is we would propose to extend a reach back for extended benefits. As Lori indicated, Congress extended the Emergency Unemployment Compensation extension, but they also extended many of the provisions that were in the original American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that provided an extra $25 a week for claimants. It also provided for full funding of the 20 weeks of extended benefits, which is normally shared by states and the federal government 50-50. Because they're now extending that full funding, we want to make sure that we can reach anybody that's potentially eligible for extended benefits. We did this through House Bill 2203 in the 2009 session. We want to extend those provisions and add that to this concept. Again, I can't stress enough that this will be fully federally funded, no impact to our trust fund. There's an approximate number of 2,000 unemployed Oregonians we could reach with this reach back. And if all applied, we could bring as much as $9.5 million to unemployed Oregonians through the federal funding. So that's the concept in a nutshell. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
So I think we're all digesting this along with you. I guess I'll start off with asking you a question. So when I'm looking at the two provisions that are in here, and the first one, the expansion of the Oregon Emergency Benefits, is that correct?
That's correct.
That we be there?
Right, that's correct.
Says $19 million projected to be expended by mid-April. So how do we, when we add these two together, what did they total?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I don't know if you could really add these together, and here's why. Some people on the that qualify for the Oregon Emergency Benefits, the state-funded extension, wouldn't be eligible for the extended benefits reach back. And that's because the federal government has a wage credit or a wage threshold that has to be met. So while some will get could possibly get both, it's more of an either-or kind of a proposition. We would reach people through OEB that have exhausted all their federal benefits through the middle of April. And then extended benefits would be for people that we could use that money for and maybe lessen the burden or the grab of the $19 million, if you will.
So, I think that does make sense, and I'm pretty much answering my own question by looking at the handout, because the extended benefits reach back is additional federal funds that we access by making this change.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. So, yes, Senator Monroe, please.
On the trust fund, you didn't have a chart in here showing, you know, where we were with the trust fund, how much it's been depleted and so on. Can you elucidate us a bit on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, the trust fund, and we typically show you that chart in terms of what the balances are, and we can get that to you if you would like for the December forecast. But the fact of the matter is that the Tom has it here, but the good news is because the federal government did extend the programs through the end of February, that the trust fund balances have come up some from the prior forecast because we're spending federal money and not our own trust fund money for these programs for an additional 2 months. So that means that the health of the balances in the trust fund are higher than what we talked about previously. I had sent an update letter to legislators saying that we would project there's a potential for short-term borrowing needed in 2011 and 2012, if you recall, the first quarter. These balances are up above now into the positive by about 200. So we think that we won't have to do short-term borrowing. But again, that depends right now on if there's additional federal extension to the end of June for the benefits here, which Congress is taking up right now. That will make this a little bit healthier. So every time they pick up the tab and we get a little bit of bump here, the R Trust Fund's in better health. So I can follow up and get you the chart with those balances if that would be helpful. But trust fund's in a little better position balance-wise because of that.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Our trust fund historically is more solvent than most states. Is that correct? Is that still the case?
That is, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that is still the case.
And it's interesting that many states, in fact, are having to do the short-term borrowing to cover their unemployment costs. Is that correct?
Most, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, most of the states are doing long-term borrowing right now. I'll give you some numbers here in a minute, but the short-term borrowing is just cash flow issue because of the collection of the tax receipts are lowest in the last quarter of the year because the wage threshold of $30,000 or so has been reached earlier in the year. So that's why our trust fund has a low collection period the first quarter. So we always were talking about short-term borrowing just until the tax receipts came in for the first quarter, which would be April time period, but most of the states that Tom's going to talk about here have long-term solvency issues, which we don't see that we have.
Yeah, well, let me get to my concern. I have a couple of concerns. One is we're doing it right. Some states obviously have not planned well enough and kept their trust fund up to meet the needs, and as a result, they're having to borrow from the federal government. From my understanding, is zero interest.
Correct.
Which in essence means that states like Oregon that don't have to do that are subsidizing those states that have not well planned. That troubles me. There's nothing I can do about it, but it troubles me. The other concern I have is as we bump up to Tier 8 in 2011 and 2012, the highest tax rate on our schedule, we haven't looked at whether or not the cap should be lifted a bit. Cap is at, what, about 50,000?
We're talking about the taxable
The
taxable wage base is 31,000.
Okay.
It's actually $32,100.
$32,000. Does it adjust upward?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, it adjusts. It's indexed to wages. As wages go up in Oregon, the taxable wage base goes up. And frankly, I was just talking to a USA Today reporter. That's why our trust fund has remained healthy, whereas other states have kept their taxable wage bases flatlined, some as low as $7,000.
Yeah, well, I think $32,000 is too low. I would prefer to see a much lower tax rate applied to a greater percentage of our total wages. There's a lot of people that are earning $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000, and yet, you know, the tax on their wages is the same as on a person earning $32,000. That troubles me a bit.
Senator Monroe, I'm going to jump in too and then let the department comment. I attended a national conference on unemployment insurance in December where I was invited to speak about the changes that we had made here in Oregon during the regular session, including adopting the alternate base year so that we could access $85 million into our trust fund. And we are really, the word jealous comes to mind, because when you talk to people from other states all over the country, and your points are well taken, they see what we have done here by being able to use the safety net, access the maximum in federal funds, and keep a solvent trust fund as a model that they would like to adopt. But I think your point is well taken, that because so many states are borrowing and in trouble, there is sort of a working coalition developing among the states like Oregon who do have a similar situation, who do have self-adjusting funds, that if at some point in the future, we don't know what the powers that be in Washington will do, but if there is some action taken, either forgiveness of these loans, that there needs to be a quid pro quo for the states like us that have done everything right. And I think that's a strong, loud voice that I hear from our members of Congress. Certainly, Senator Wyden's office has been very, very outspoken about this, and I think the other states too. So that was my comment, and maybe you'd care to comment too.
Well, I really thank you, Madam Chair, for your work in this. It troubles me because we're a net donor state. We send more money to Washington than we get back in all federal programs. And this if we're in fact subsidizing other states that don't have a solvent program, which we are in essence, if they can borrow for no interest, we're in fact subsidizing them. That troubles me because it just contributes to the fact that we're a net donor state, not a recipient state like many of our friends.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, like Senator Rosenbaum, I've been involved in a number of those meetings at the national level and the discussions with the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, and that is very much on the agenda in terms of states feeling like it not end up being unfair for those of us who have maintained solvent funds. So I think that voice is pretty loud, and feeling like we've done more than our part and that they ought to figure out how to get in better shape. So I think, you know, after some of the dust settles here, there will be a discussion. Many of the states would rather borrow, bond, etc., to repay this than fund it up front. I was in a meeting with Texas and California and New York's of the world, and, you know, they just saw that as a better strategy rather than salting, you know, the money away ahead of time, that they would rather clean it up on the back end. So, I mean, that's just a policy choice their state's making as to how they deal with it. And they said, oh, don't worry, we'll deal with it. But at least the New York and the Texas. The California folks were less confident about how they were going to deal with it. But, you know, it is on the radar.
Well, and as long as they're not paying any price, as long as they can borrow free money zero interest, there's really no incentive for them to fix their problem.
Well, and they did, Senator Rosemont, they did say that. So I do think that's an issue in terms of interest-free loans. And, of course, they would like to see those continue. So it is to their advantage.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Senator Monroe. And I'm just to bring us back to, I guess it doesn't totally bring us back to this bill, but obviously the formula is not changed in any way in this bill, and I have not heard anybody's intention to revisit that during the February session, which is what this bill introduction will be aimed at.
Madam Chair, committee, this is a continuation of the Oregon Emergency Benefits as you approved it last session, essentially just for some additional weeks. The add-on is the look back for the extended benefits, which we also did last time too, but the bill makes that a change that is permanent so that when the federal government picks up more than 50%, we would, by administrative rule, go ahead and do that in the department and take advantage of those funds.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I hope nobody out in our audience construes my discussion as objection to this change. I strongly support it. I think we need to do everything we can for those unfortunate people in our state that are not able to find a job, and so unemployment insurance to me is the best stimulus money that we can spend, because 100% of it gets spent, so rather than providing tax credits to wealthy people or whatever, unemployment insurance is something I'm a strong supporter of. I'm glad Oregon is doing a good job of keeping our program solvent. I wish there were incentives to force other states to do likewise.
Thank you, Senator Monroe, and thank you, Director Warner, and Tom, for being here again. And so I think at this point, we've been joined by Representative Tina Kotek, one of our House colleagues, and welcome to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. I think Representative Kotek is here for the next two items on the agenda. We are at the moment, unfortunately, we cannot deputize you as a senator.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And I have a feeling Speaker Hunt might object if we tried it.
Yeah,
so we're still without a quorum, and I think we will have one shortly. So I think what I will do at this point is we're still in a work session on LC-26, and I can additionally open a work session.
Yes.
I'll open a work session on LC-5, and for the purpose of having the committee administrator just review what LC-5 is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To refresh your memory, committee members and loyal followers of this committee, we had an informational hearing on this, on the topic surrounding LC-5 at our November 19th hearing. What the concept does is that it aligns the bargaining units, organizational election process for Oregon University System faculty to what it's like in all other bargaining units. If you recall, the current process is a two-ballot system. This would, again, align it so that it's one ballot and identical to all other bargaining units.
Thank you, Teresa. And as our capable administrator has indicated, we took pretty voluminous testimony on this concept at our last hearing. Obviously, today we're going to be in a work session where we'll vote shortly, and we will, during February, be holding an additional public hearing before this bill moves forward. But if there are any questions from the committee member who's here today, we certainly, I think the administrator could probably answer them.
Yes.
The exhibits are going to be reviewed for members, too, who might have forgotten some of that great testimony that we had at our last hearing. Senator Monroe, did you have any questions about this?
I remember the testimony, and I'm strongly supporting this concept. I think it levels the playing field, I guess, is something that we like to say.
Great. So I think because I don't want to have to disrupt anything, I'll just be at ease for a moment as we're awaiting the Senate President, so committee is at ease. committee will come back to order, and we are in a work session on two LCs, LC 5 and LC 26. But before we take action, I would like to welcome Senate President Peter Courtney, who in his, I don't know if it's ex officio, I think it's officio capacity, is a member of all committees of the Senate. And since he informed me recently that he was a student of Latin, I wanted to work some Latin into this hearing. So that was the extent of the Latin I was going to use, the ex officio part. Senator Courtney, did you have any comments? Quid pro quo? Quod erat demonstrandum? He's
very well.
Speechless.
Nicely done.
Okay, and I do see that we've now been joined by another.
Does that mean I leave now?
Senator Larry George, I think now that you're here, you might as well cast your vote.
You can follow you.
So,
are you ready for a motion?
Yes, and six more days. Senator George, you did miss testimony on two LCs, which are about to be introduced
as committee
bills.
Go easy on me. Tells me 6 days from becoming a father.
A father, yes. That's what I understand.
Right. We're thrilled that he's here. Yeah, yes, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that we introduce LC Concept 5 as a committee bill for consideration during the February session.
Senator Monroe has moved that LC 5, which is a bill that we took considerable testimony on at our previous hearing, Senator George, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay. Motion passes, and LC 5 will be introduced as a committee bill from Senate Commerce and Workforce Development. And
Madam Chair,
Senator Monroe.
I move that we introduce Legislative Concept 26 as a committee bill for consideration during the February session.
Senator Monroe has moved that LC 26 be introduced as a committee bill for the February session. For your benefit, Senator George, though you missed the testimony, we did just hear from the Employment Department, and this is a small unemployment insurance extension using funds that were allocated during the regular session for a similar purpose. So we have a motion before us. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, the motion is adopted, and LC 26 will be introduced as a committee bill from Senate Commerce and Workforce Development. And I will close the work session, and I'll open an informational hearing. And the topic of this informational hearing, as you can see on the agenda, is employment-related daycare. I believe we have, and we are having a panel of witnesses. I believe they're all here in the room. So if they could please come forward, and Roberta Weber, Ellen Scott, and Deborah Murray. Thank you for being here today, and we will let you introduce yourselves once the committee staff has your testimony. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And just a little background for the members, the subject of employment-related daycare is obviously one that has a lot to do with workforce development, because having people have the ability to have their kids taken care of is directly connected with their ability to stay employed. And in this rough economy that we have been facing in our state and nationally, that's a major priority. So I appreciate your being here, and we're looking forward to hearing your testimony. If you could go in whatever order you've decided and just introduce yourself for the record, and then tell us what you have to say.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Roberta Weber, and I'm a researcher at Oregon State University in the Family Policy Program. We thank you for the opportunity to share information on child care as an economic development for and workforce and the critical role that employment-related daycare plays in the employment of low-wage parents. I'll begin our panel, and I'm going to give you kind of an overview of the role that the industry plays in the economy, and then I'm going to also talk about the employment-related daycare program's role in that. Ellen Scott from the University of Oregon will describe findings from a current study that gives us insights into exactly how ERDC affects families. And then Deborah Murray, the Executive Director of Peninsula Children's Center, will describe the program's impacts on low-wage employees and child care facilities. So the child care industry affects the economy in three distinct ways. First, it generates income and creates jobs. Secondly, investing in disadvantaged young children has been proved to have very high returns. And third, child care enables parents to work and at the same time meet the developmental needs of their children. So I'm going to address each very briefly. The first, according to an economic impact study conducted by OSU in 2005, the child care and education industry generates $639 million in revenue, more than milk production, advertising firms, newspapers, or gas stations. It employs almost 15,000 workers, putting it on a par with greenhouse and nurseries and private colleges and universities. So although it's very invisible to the general public, it's a major force within our state. Secondly, it directly supports the economy. In testimony before U.S. Congress, Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman reported that early education represents the most cost-effective workforce development strategy available. These investments have both high benefit ratios and rates of return. In addition, the federal funds themselves directly have a multiplier effect in the economy. In Kansas, a state that's slightly smaller than Oregon, they did an analysis that showed that a loss of $3.3 million in CCDF, the Federal Child Care and Development Fund, was estimated to result in a direct loss of 217 jobs and an additional loss of $3.2 million in the state economy. And we're talking about a far bigger cut and would have a commensurate far bigger impact on the state's economy. And thirdly, child care supports parental employment. Over 90,000 Oregon parents rely on child care to work, and they earn nearly $2.6 billion annually. Child care prices, which these parents have to pay, put child care out of reach for low-wage working families. Even though the people who get their wages from this industry earn typically slightly above the minimum wage, nowhere near commensurate with the skills and knowledge and education they need to do this work. So in Oregon, the annual price of center care for a toddler is about almost $10,000, which represents 60% of a minimum wage earner's earnings. And it's greater than the tuition in our public universities. So, attached to your testimony is a little profile of child care with data for your actual counties. So that situation leads us to employment-related daycare. Without ERDC, low-wage workers cannot access the child care facilities in their community. It's just out of bounds. Some low-wage workers do have family members who will take care of the children for nothing. But for a substantial portion of Oregon families in this low-wage work group, they either don't have family and close friends that are available to them to help, or these family and friend members need income to survive themselves, and so they cannot give up their jobs and take care of the children. For those parents, ERDC becomes the essential ingredient to stay employed. Research has documented the relationship between stable use of a child care subsidy and employment, and the a study now being conducted that you're going to hear about in a minute from Ellen shows the mechanics, how exactly this operates within the family that makes ERDC such a critical support that enables people to stay in the workforce. The current budget includes a major cut to ERDC starting in July 2001. It'll have a major impact on almost 3,000 households, 5,500 children. We say that eligibility for this program is up to 185% of poverty, which is in fact true, but that's not who's using the program. The average earnings of families who are using the program is $595 a month, and you compare that with the cost of child care. It becomes clear that these families need this help to stay employed. They cannot access the community supply. The parents who lose a subsidy because of this cut will have no good choices. Some will leave their children alone. Others will create a patchwork, an unstable, where they talk this friend into this many hours and they move the children around and they'll try to make it. The effects of this on their job performance and on the children will be obviously negatively impacted. Job performance may be so low that they lose their job or that they just quit in despair that their children, that they put their children at such risk that they can't keep doing it. Failing to fully fund ERDC certainly threatens both unemployment and welfare rolls as these families try to figure out how they're going to make it. ERDC impacts not only the economic stability of families, but the productivity of businesses and local economies throughout the state. It also brings millions of dollars into Oregon, which is put at risk when we make this big a cut. And at a time when Oregon most needs families to remain employed, it is critical to save ERDC.
Thank you, Professor, and you did, I think, intend to say that the funding for this program would be exhausted this coming July in 2010.
Yes. And what did I say?
You said 01.
Oh!
Just so you'll know that we're listening to every word that you're saying up here.
And I didn't even hear it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I will hear from all the witnesses and then take a few questions if there are any. Please go ahead.
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Scott. I'm on the faculty at the University of Oregon in the Department of Sociology, and I head Women's Studies there. Thanks a lot for taking time to hold the hearing today. We appreciate your time immensely. Since last February, I've been conducting interviews with working families who receive ERDC, employment-related daycare subsidies. And in those interviews, we review in depth their histories of employment and child care arrangements, including any other options that they might have for child care if they were to lose the current subsidized arrangement. The interviews make absolutely explicit, first of all, that most families do not have access to family, friends, or neighbors who could provide the child care for free. And indeed, the child care subsidies provide a job and an income for those providing the care, whether they are family, friends, neighbors, or licensed providers. Two, if the families lose the subsidy, they will lose their child care. They cannot afford, as Bobby has just said, to pay for market rates for child care. Most of the families we interviewed earn far below the federal poverty level in their income. Even an income federal poverty level of $14,500 for a family of two exceeds the typical income among the families that I interviewed, and their families were larger than families of two. Most of them earned about $1,200 down to $900 or so per month, again, exceeding even the average that Bobby just quoted. But that's the income for most of the families we spoke with, and they would have to use their entire month's salary to pay for child care if they lost their subsidy. Clearly, that is not a tenable situation for them. And finally, if they lose their child care, they will have to quit their jobs. And that it really is that simple. Of course, if 2,900 families lose their subsidies and then their child care and then their jobs, they will undoubtedly apply for TANF benefits in order to survive. And we have tried very hard to move away from that in the last 10 years. It's quite disturbing to imagine that our policies are moving back in the direction of reliance on TANF. All of the 44 women we interviewed said that without a subsidy, they could not work, or the trade-offs in meeting their family's basic needs would be disastrous. They often referred to the mandate that they be, quote, self-sufficient, but they were quite clear that without a subsidy for child care, they couldn't meet this mandate, something that they, too, aspired to. And clearly, work support, such as child care assistance, are still imperative, something that we recognized a decade ago when we were in the process of reducing welfare benefits and moving people from welfare to work. So let me give you a little bit of the direct words from the people I interviewed. Here are two examples of what women we spoke with said when we asked them what they would do if they didn't have a child care subsidy. One woman, Rachel, who has three children, said, without child care assistance, I wouldn't be able to work. I'd have to stop working, basically. I'd have to quit my job, and then I'd be back at the same. I'd be like, I can't work. I can't work because I can't pay child care. My provider makes something like $1,500 a month off of my two boys, and I would have to pay $1,500. I don't make that much each month, so I'd have to stop working. And Mary, who also has three children, said, I could work, but I'd be living out of a box or my car. Because how do you pay rent and pay daycare? If you have two kids, you're looking at $1,100 to $1,200 a month in child care. How do you do that and work, especially as a single mom? If I didn't have a child care subsidy, we'd be living in a cardboard box. So I'm glad that we do. So then I can work and do what I'm supposed to do. Now, I want to provide you with one story that illustrates what might happen if we eliminate a subsidy for the working parents in Oregon who currently receive that child care subsidy. This is the story of Julia, who has three children, and her story really illustrates the critical importance of the child care subsidy in maintaining both the stability of employment and also her child care arrangements. Julia, who has two school-age and one preschool-age child, was self-employed cleaning apartments for landlords between tenants. Between their tenants, she would go in and do a thorough cleaning. She had built up a decent clientele and was getting enough jobs to make ends meet. She reported earning about $12,000 in the year prior to when we interviewed her. Her mother took care of her children. And she said, and quote, I started working 3 years. I started at first arranging my schedule around my kids' school hours, which worked, but then I was losing jobs by doing it that way. And then it got to the point where I would have to pick up my kids from the bus stop, and I would take them with me to work. But then I ended up working 2 or 3 hours longer, and the interviewer says, cleaning up after your kids? And she says, yeah. And then one time we walked into a place, and somebody had broken in. And I'm like, this is not safe for you guys. So that was when I talked to my mom, and we've been good in the child care for 2 years. So she needed extremely flexible hours. She worked on demand, often working evenings, weekends, and of course days. And her mother was willing to come to her house whenever she was needed. And she took care of the kids 20 to 50 hours a week. Her hours varied considerably. And in our first interview with her, Julia remarked that if she lost her subsidy, she was confident that her mother would still take care of her kids. And then when we spoke to her, a few months later, she reported that she had lost her subsidy because she was one of those who was self-employed and was cut off in April last year. Her mother then stopped providing the care because she could not afford to do so without the pay that she had been receiving. Since then, Julia had struggled to find care. And when she could, she paid friends and her mother out of pocket. She left her older child alone, something that she had previously said to us she would never do because Julia had had a boyfriend who had stalked her. Now she resorted to leaving her child in what she considered an unsafe situation. She would split her younger children up and put them with different friends when necessary, and she often could not take cleaning jobs because there was no one available to care for her children. The loss of the subsidy meant that Julia's employment was at risk and her children were no longer in stable, safe arrangements. For her, this was a devastating blow to her previously stable life as a low-wage, self-employed worker, and it was a blow to her self-esteem. In her interview, she said to us, I built this business, something I built out of nothing. I didn't have a dime to my name. This is more than work. This is who I am. I may clean for a living, and a lot of people look down on this, but I don't get child care, and I don't have child support. So I want to just conclude by reiterating how critically important ERDC is to low-wage workers in maintaining their employment and in maintaining safe, stable arrangements in child care for their children. Without this subsidy, a lot of families will be at risk of losing their employment. They can't afford to pay the market cost of child care in the state. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Professor Scott. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and the committee. My name is Deborah Murray, and I'm the executive director of Peninsula Children's Center in North Portland. Peninsula Children's Center is a large not-for-profit child care center that has existed in North Portland for almost 40 years now and has always had a mission to serve that community being about half of our clientele is on ERDC. North Portland is one of the most diverse communities in Portland, both socioeconomically and racially. And we are very proud to be part of a player in the community that pulls that diversity together in lots and lots of different ways, beginning with the fact that the families who bring their children to us trust us and want the best for their children, whether or not they're able to pay for it. I'm here to talk to you today basically from three perspectives. First, as a provider, second, as an employer, and second, as a 35-year professional in the field of early childhood education. As a provider, I can tell you that in our early childhood setting, which is where the preponderance of our ERDC families are, that we are currently licensed for 92 children between the ages of birth and 5 years old. We are fully enrolled at this point. Of those 92 children, 45 are on ERDC. That encompasses 33 families, or approximately a third of our enrollment is there and taking advantage of our services because of their child care subsidy. I have brought along a letter that I have given to your assistant from one of our parents who talks very similarly to what Ellen was talking about, except sort of one notch above. Nina was on TANF in 2006 because of domestic violence, because of a very unhealthy home situation. Her children were taken away from her and put in foster care, and she was put on a program to get herself straightened out to find the support that she needed through a variety of social service agencies. She was successful in that regard, and in 2007 she got her children back. At that point she needed to go to work and she needed to have child care, and so she brought her three children under the age of six to us. We took them on at that point, all of them on ERDC, and over the course of several additional months of being on the jobs program, Nina was able to find herself a job at St. Vincent's Hospital as a medical assistant. She's very proud of that job, and she's very proud of the fact that she grosses $1,800 a month. On that, she's supporting her children, she's paying her rent, and she can provide for her children. However, her child care bill is over $2,000 a month, having three children under the age of five. I can't afford to provide care for any less than what I'm already charging, and Peninsula Children's Center is also heavily dependent on foundations and an extensive grant program and development program in order to keep our doors open. I need ERDC as an employer, as a provider of care, and Nina needs it in order to stay a contributing member to her community. I can also tell you, as an employer in North Portland, that strange as it sounds, we are considered a moderate to large employer in North Portland, and we have 35 full-time employees and another six or seven on-call substitutes that we bring in. We are a year-round program. Of those 35 employees, four of my lead teachers are single mothers who use ERDC to have their children at our center. It's the only way they can afford quality child care for their children. If with these cuts, I would lose those four key staff members, and they would lose when they lost their child care. I need those teachers. We've invested in them in terms of their professional development. They are on track to get associate's degrees through other support programs that the child care community has brought together with the help of foundations and other incentives. They're also being helped at this point by federal dollars. They are key to my program, but ERDC is key to their being employed. Finally, as an educator who has been in this field for a very long time, I'd just like to reiterate what Bobby and Ellen were saying, that we now have a growing body of research that clearly says that an investment in children between the ages of 0 to 5, for every $1 invested, depending on the study you look at, we reap the benefits of anywhere from $7 to $12 saved down the line in terms of intervention programs, teen pregnancy, dropping out of school. On the positive side, it's been proven to increase employability in terms of becoming contributing parts of the community themselves. It is one of the keys to breaking the cycle of poverty. By cuts to ERDC, you not only throw these parents back into a cycle of poverty and dependent on TANF, but in a large measure, we're taking the risk of condemning their children to continuing to participate in that cycle of poverty. I can also tell you that quality child care, which costs money, makes a difference. Low quality child care, the kind of patched together child care that Ellen has talked about, actually damages families and damages the development of children. I'm very proud to tell you that even with over half of our children participating from low income families, we know through the quarterly assessments that we do on children that 95% of our children who are participating across the board are meeting developmental milestones, are on track to be successful when they hit public school, and of those 5% that aren't meeting those benchmarks, we have connected them with programs that will get them there. That's the kind of an impact that quality child care can have on families, on a community, and on the children that we serve. And I just ask you to please, please do whatever you can to make sure that these cuts don't crash that system on all three fronts. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for your excellent testimony and also for the work that you do, particularly at Peninsula, taking care of these kids. It strikes me that this program is really the intersection of everything that is stressing families in good times, but particularly as we're facing the worst recession, what's now being called the Great Recession since the Great Depression, and obviously being able to have people stay employed, have their kids taken care of, and be able to feed their families and know that those children are not in danger while the parent or parents are at work is just, I think, everything that most Oregonians want to see happen. And the unfortunate reality, as I'm sure we'll probably hear a few more comments about, is that with scarce resources, we were able to actually fund this program, but only through the beginning of July. And so that is really the reality that we will be talking about, I'm sure, in February. So at this point, we don't have a huge amount of time for questions or comments, but I will open it up and entertain some. And Senator Monroe?
Well, just briefly, Representative Kotek and I both serve on the Child Care Commission. My wife was a nonprofit child care director for 20 years, so I'm pretty familiar with this. I also am very concerned about a related issue, which is providing child care for students, especially for community college students. I'm on the board of Mount Hood Community College, and we're working to build a new child care facility on the campus that will be coordinated by Head Start. But besides the fact that many single parents especially can't afford to work and pay child care, they certainly also can't afford to go to college and pay tuition and pay for child care. And so I think those twin issues are very related. If people can get an education and lift themselves up and get a better paying job than a minimum wage job, they can certainly contribute to society, and many of them, without child care being provided or subsidized, just are out of luck. Yeah. So I appreciate the work you're doing, appreciate your testimony. I'm going to do all I can to make sure that this program does not end next July.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Monroe. Senator George, Do you have your calculator out? I think the audience members may or may not know that we're very thrilled that Senator George and his wife are about to have their first child, and so I'm sure this topic takes on whole new significance, but everything else probably pales by just, I'm looking for your pager there. And I'm sure you have it nearby. Great. Thank you very much. And Representative Kotek, I'm glad that you're here because I know you've done a lot of work on this issue, so please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for talking about this in the context of our economy and workforce development. I want to thank Deborah and Peninsula Center, that is in my district, and all the great work you do, and Ellen and Bobby for documenting our child care system here in the state. I think it's ironic. I want to go back to the very first numbers that Bobby put out on the economic impact study was done in 2005. We're talking about an industry that directly and indirectly contributes millions of dollars into the economy. I would assume that 15,000 worker number is larger today because that study's a few years old. I think if we were talking about cutting a tax break or two for an industry that had 15,000 workers and it was going to put people out of work, we would certainly be paying attention. I know why the employment-related daycare cut is scheduled for July 1. We have limited resources. We need to do everything we can to keep that from happening because not only will parents lose their jobs, providers will lose their jobs. The indirect effect on the economy in terms of purchasing services and other things will be there. And this is the last, this is not the right time to be doing that. Whether that's looking at other types of funds, other short-term funding sources to keep it rolling until the economy picks up, I think we have to do something. And I think the information you've laid out today makes that very clear. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments, and thank you for your great work on this issue, Representative Kotek. So thank you for being here, and it looks like we're right about on schedule. We did not have anybody else. I think we had one witness who was traveling from Redmond to talk about this but was not able to be here today.
I think he submitted testimony, that was his plan.
Okay, so if there's written testimony, our committee assistant will make sure all the members get it. And I should also say that Senator Telfer was not able to be with us today, but certainly will be receiving your testimony and the other testimony, as Senator Prezansky, who is in court in Florence. Unfortunately, it's his court day over there, and he will be gathering the testimony and taking it very seriously, I'm sure. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And at this point, I'll close the informational hearing on employment-related daycare, and I will open an informational meeting on employment and credit reports. And we do have, just for the members, I'll give you a little background on this topic. So the topic of the use of job applicants' credit history has been one that's been much in the news for quite some period of time. We are holding today an informational hearing on that subject just to get a variety of perspectives on what the practices are, on what some of the legal aspects of this might be. And we do, I want to stress that we have now an LC, which is, once again, like the other one we talked about, hot off the presses. I believe that now it has been placed out on the dais. We didn't have it prior to today's hearing because the Bureau of Labor and Industries were actually reviewing the draft. So I'm going to ask the witnesses, some of whom are coming into the room, I'll just say once again that the testimony today is primarily of an informational nature. We invited people that we thought had some knowledge or experience with this topic, but this is by no means meant to be a hearing on the bill, which has not yet been introduced, and there will be ample opportunity in the February session to talk again about this subject and to talk in detail about this bill or any other bill that pertains to the subject of the use of credit history for employment purposes. So we have several witnesses. We're going to go pretty much in the order we have them listed, but a little flexibility because of time. So first we have with us Representative Tina Kotek, and please go ahead and lead this off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative for House District 44, which is North and Northeast Portland. And thank you for the opportunity to come and share my thoughts today on, in this informational meeting about the use of credit history checks in employment decisions. I really applaud the committee for looking at this important topic. In these challenging economic times, many people are on the cusp of missing a mortgage payment, not making rent, or not paying their bills on time. We've all heard the stories from our constituents. Many have already been overwhelmed by financial hardship and have lost their homes to foreclosure, declared bankruptcy, or damaged their credit history with a litany of late payments. We are all hearing heart-wrenching stories from constituents who are unable to see where to go next. In my capacity as co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, I'm keenly aware of how many Oregonians are striving to hold their lives together, counting on food stamps and other supports to see them through the recovery and to new job opportunities. So as Oregon's economy improves, I believe it's our responsibility not only to help our constituents overcome challenges in the short term, but to anticipate problems on the horizon and craft good public policy that creates smoother sailing in the near future for our constituents and the entire state. This is why I support legislative action to limit the use of credit history checks by employers in the job hiring process. Credit checks are becoming more common as a pre-employment screening tool, just as people's credit histories have been thrown into turmoil. A 2009 survey by the Society for Human Resource Management reports that 60% of employers check a job applicant's credit history before making a hiring decision. Job seekers in this poor economy find themselves in a catch-22 situation of being unable to improve their credit by getting a job because their credit history may be preventing them from getting hired in the first place. When employers evaluate job applicants, they do need to be able to form a complete picture of how the applicant would perform in the position. But there is no proven correlation between credit standing and job performance. There is also no proven correlation between credit standing and potential criminal activity. Another reason to limit the use of credit checks by employers is that credit reports contain inaccurate information despite the best efforts of the credit reporting companies. One in four credit reports have a significant error, with more containing minor errors. Fixing these errors can be challenging and time-consuming, not necessarily possible in the time frame of applying for a job. Having bad credit does not mean that a person will be a bad employee or that they are more likely to commit fraud. Again, our job is to remove barriers for individuals to get back to work and help our state's economic recovery. I support moving legislation in the special session that would limit the use of credit checks by employers so most job applicants can be considered on the merit of their skills, not their troubled credit histories. I also support some exceptions for certain businesses, such as federally insured banks and credit unions and public safety agencies, and when mandated by law. But again, for the bulk of employers out there, using credit history checks for their job applicants is really inappropriate and does create a barrier in these bad economic times for those folks looking for work. So, colleagues, I look forward to working with you on this to help improve employment opportunities for Oregonians, and thank you again for this conversation. I look forward to the discussion on the piece of legislation that will be coming out in February. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kotek. And are there questions? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you so much. I'm not familiar, actually, with we don't use credit checks in any of our hiring. So just based on your testimony, why are you in favor of credit checks for financial institutions and public safety if there's no correlation between those credit reports and job performance or illegal behavior? What's the decision? Why did you carve those two out and say you're in favor of it there, but not for the rest of it if there is no correlation?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Senator George, I think that's a great question. I think that when we look at what other states are doing, and you'll hear from Angela Martin in a moment here about what other states have done, that has been the precedence in other states. And so you have a lot of those industries already using credit checks very heavily. Personally, I think we should do away with them completely. But in the spirit of compromise and for industries who have been using it for a long time, I think that change would be significant. I think mostly with this bill, we want to make sure we don't we stop the halt of other companies that have, there's no relationship at all to any kind of financial information for a particular job, and unfortunately that's what we're seeing. So this could, you know, stop that expansion in its tracks while preserving what for some folks in the industry thinks are very important tools to have, whether or not I agree with that or not.
And I think Senator George, you'll be hearing from other witnesses who might also be able to shed some light on your question.
I'm just unfamiliar with the issue, and so I just thought that was interesting.
And that's why we're doing an informational hearing. So, okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Kotek, and you would be welcome to join us at the dais if your time allows you to do so. And next on our witness list, we have the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I see Kate Newhall in the audience, so if you'd like to come forward. And welcome back. You're a frequent and always popular visitor to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. So,
well, thank you.
We're glad to see you again.
For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here with today with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of LC 27, which would prohibit employers from obtaining or from using credit history information to make employment decisions, except in very limited circumstances. The Bureau sees this legislation as a necessary protection against employment discrimination and applauds the committee for looking at this important topic in the February session. Protection of employment rights is one of the core missions of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and our Civil Rights Division is responsible for the enforcement of all unlawful employment practices under ORS Chapter 659A. The protection envisioned in LC 27 is appropriately placed under BOLI's jurisdiction to enforce civil rights law in the state. While there's not currently any provision in state or federal law that specifically prohibits employers from using a person's credit history to make the employment decisions, I think it's important to note that our federal counterpart, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, advises against the use of credit histories to make employment decisions and warns that the practice might result in discrimination and violate Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Towards this end, the EEOC has actually recently charged in a federal lawsuit that a particular employer violated Title VII and engaged in pattern and practice discrimination by using credit reports and arrest records to screen their job applicants, since it had neither a job-related function or was justified as a business necessity. We support LC 27 because it would codify in state statute the prohibition of using a person's credit history to make employment decisions by making it an unlawful employment practice under civil rights law. The provisions would be enforceable either through BOLI's administrative law process or through private action, which is similar to most other unlawful employment practices in 659A. The concept includes four specific exemptions, although I'm just going to talk about one particular exemption, which is related directly to the use of credit histories for a bona fide occupational qualification that is necessary to the operation of the employer's business, and the information in the credit history has a substantial relationship to the functions and responsibilities of the job. In employment law, a bona fide occupational qualification is a quality or an attribute that employers are allowed to consider when they're making decisions on the hiring or retention of employees, qualities that otherwise, when considered in other contexts, might be considered forms of discrimination and violations of civil rights law. The term bona fide occupational qualification appears both in state and federal civil rights law and is a well-known standard that is appropriate for use in this instance. Last, I want to thank the committee for allowing the Bureau the opportunity to review this legislation and offer our technical feedback as the concept was drafted. And this is a bill that BOLI supports as protecting both Oregon employees and job applicants. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Kate. And I'll, I think, will you be able to stay with us if there are other questions that pop up as we continue through the hearing? I did want to just sort of piggyback on Senator George's question about why there would be exceptions in the law or whether these exceptions are ones that are clear to the Bureau.
These exceptions are absolutely clear to the Bureau. I think they're very well defined in the legislation. And again, including the exception for other bona fide occupational qualifications is a test that allows other jobs or applicants that might have a direct relation that aren't specifically exempted in the legislation to also allow the use of credit histories in those instances.
Okay, thank you. Senator George, go ahead.
Kate, just because I'm, again, unfamiliar with the issue, are you seeing complaints filed with your office from employees who have been discriminated against based on this? And can you give me kind of a scenario, a generic scenario that you're talking about? Because I'm trying to figure out exactly how somebody would use this to discriminate or how that would affect.
At the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we don't specifically track the cases that come in alleging discrimination based on one of these screening tools, but the EEOC does, and their most recent statistic, what we track at the Bureau of Labor and Industries are more just the number and types of discrimination complaints we get, so how many complaints we get on race, gender, age. The EEOC tracks their complaints also with what sort of the tool was. And in their most recent statistic was in fiscal year of 2007, they had 304 complaints of discrimination alleging some type of employment screening tool was used. So the employment screening tool could be a credit history, it could be some sort of other test that an employer might use. So.
Is that in Oregon or nation or? I'm sorry, I missed what, 300
it is,
and...
It is nationally, but what they say is that statistic has been increasing steadily since 2005, as employers use more and more employment tests and screens.
One last question.
Yes, go ahead.
Give me an example, just so I'm understanding, how would this be used to discriminate against somebody that would be... You're looking for a quality of character. That's why mm-hmm. mortgage companies look at your credit report. You're looking for a quality of character, somebody who's reliable, those kind of things. How would this be discriminatory, just so I understand?
I think that it could be discriminatory either intentionally or unintentionally if the ultimate end result of the practice is that it has the effect of discriminating against a particular class as they apply for a job. So if a credit screen was found to discriminate against a particular race more than other races, that's where it could have a discriminatory impact.
Thank you.
But I think, too, to clarify, and we'll certainly talk a lot more about this if this bill does end up being introduced, which I think it probably will. But to clarify, you know, for the Bureau would not really be able to process complaints or do anything with them right now if people were calling about this because there is no law on the books that they have to enforce. So that really is what this proposes to do, is create some limitations on the use of this information. And just to clarify, there are other states which have done that. So we have some experience, and we certainly can, as we move forward, get witnesses from those states who can talk to us about how that's working, how it's implemented. But I know that as this concept was developed, and I did not really, until this morning, get the agency's final review of it, it is modeled on laws that exist and are being enforced in other places. So,
Kate's going to be available after we hear the rest of the testimony. I don't want to keep asking her questions,
right,
that other people are going to answer.
Absolutely. So, yeah, she said I think that she can stay with us. Great. Okay, thank you very much, Kate. And next, we're going to go a little bit out of order, and we're going to call Eric Rosenberg, who has traveled from some distance, and I believe you have a friend that you wanted to bring up with you. And I see a friend of ours, J.L. Wilson, who has been very busy these days because I get lots of emails from him and see his name frequently traveling around the state. So I appreciate, J.L., that you could take time to be with us today. And please go ahead. Did you have written testimony for us today?
I do. I didn't. I have prepared remarks. However, I did not know that I was supposed to bring copies with me. So I'm happy to submit those after the testimony if you'd like.
That would be great.
Okay. Madam Chairman and fellow senators and Representative Kotek, thank you for inviting me to speak with you today on this important topic. Just by way of introduction and background, as I said, as Chairman Rosenbaum said, I'm Eric Rosenberg. I'm the head of our government relations for TransUnion. We're one of the three principal consumer reporting agencies in the world. We manage operations in about consumer credit reporting operations in 26 countries. We do three main things at TransUnion. We aggregate massive amounts of information. We provide predictive analytics to businesses, and we build large-scale decision support systems as well. So the keystones of our operations are accurate information, protecting our information and making it private, and the security of the information that we hold. Oregon businesses seek credit reports on job applicants from TransUnion or other businesses for a variety of reasons, including to verify that an applicant is responsible and reliable, or to confirm identity. Other employers are concerned about hiring persons who cannot manage their affairs properly or whose monthly debt payments are too high for the salary involved. Many employers limit credit reports to management and executive positions or to positions that have access to cash, assets, a company credit card, or confidential information, including bookkeepers or others who handle significant amounts of cash. But it's not limited to that, of course. While it might not be readily apparent to many why a credit report would have applicability to a prospective employer, today's work environment, however, does necessitate due diligence in many hiring situations. I agree, probably not all situations would require or should have access to a credit report. But fraud experts say small businesses are the most vulnerable to internal theft from employees. According to the to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, the median loss suffered by organizations with fewer than 100 employees was $190,000 per incident. In fact, the typical scheme occurs at companies with fewer than 100 employees. This crime, when spread over a number of years, can force a small business into bankruptcy, and it happens quite frequently. So for many small businesses, fraud management is simply a matter of survival in today's competitive market environment. Here are some other figures by ACFE that attest to the value of properly vetting employees. First of all, companies lose a median of 5% of their annual revenue due to employee fraud. Secondly, fraud by employees accounts for $652 billion annually in business losses. Third is the median loss caused by fraud is $159,000. Nearly one quarter of the cases caused at least $1 million in losses, and nine cases, and that's in 2008. I won't even look at Bernie Madoff and the other scams going on in 2009, caused losses of $1 billion or more. So for many Oregon businesses, a credit report has become an extremely useful tool, a screening tool to evaluate a candidate and to exercise due diligence in the hiring process. I certainly, and TransUnion certainly understands that for some applicants, a credit report can feel like an invasion of privacy or a violation of their rights. However, for job applicants in Oregon, there are already substantial legal protections concerning the use of credit reports for employment. In fact, the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, which was enacted in 1970, is really the nation's first acknowledgement of privacy and authorized the use of credit reports for employment purposes in its first introduction in 1970, tightly regulates the use of consumer credit reports in employment situations. Under current law that's available to every Oregon consumer, every job applicant in Oregon, an employer cannot obtain a credit report without an applicant's written permission. So before anybody gets that job, they have to right there on the spot sign that they acknowledge and agree to their credit report being pulled for that job. Prior to requesting a consumer credit report, an employer must provide to the prospective employee a written notice each and every time stating the source of the information and how it will be used. The employer must also provide a copy of the consumer credit report to the consumer prior to taking an adverse action, which means not hiring that individual for information that might have been contained in that credit report. The applicant has a right to review that credit report and to dispute any information with the consumer credit reporting agency, such as TransUnion, that is believed to be inaccurate or incomplete. At this point in the hiring process, this also allows the consumer an opportunity to explain any potential derogatory information to that employer. And if an adverse employment action is taken against a prospective employee due to the information that's contained in the credit report, the user must provide, his prospective employer must provide the name and contact information for the credit reporting agency to the consumer and explain to that consumer the reasons for that action each and every time. No ifs, ands, or buts. And that's the obligation that that employer takes on for using credit reports under the law. That right applies even if the employer had additional reasons not to hire the person, or even if the applicant has excellent credit, but the employer has other concerns based upon the credit report, such as a reported high debt level. It may be, for example, that the debt level is overstated in the report. If a final decision is made, an applicant is also entitled from that employer a second confirming letter. In Oregon, job applicants must also be given the opportunity to request a copy of the credit report from a consumer reporting agency, such as TransUnion, free of charge if the employer obtains it. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, there's also existing substantial penalties for failure to comply and liability. And to that consumer, it can be equal to the sum of any actual damages sustained by the consumer as a result of the failure, or damages of not less than $100 and not more than $1,000 per violation. And also punitive damages, and in the case of any successful action to enforce any liability, the cost of the action with reasonable attorney's fees as determined by the court. And that's enforceable not only by private right of action, but by enforcement by the state attorney general and also by the Federal Trade Commission. Because of the cost and liability involved with complying with the law when using credit reports for employment, most Oregon businesses certainly are using them when they feel it is necessary. Unnecessary credit reports can discourage applicants from applying, and running and analyzing mass amounts of credit reports on all applicants, regardless of the position, is extremely costly, time-consuming, and rife with potential liability. To the degree that you may be worried that the recent economic downturn may present the need to protect consumers of all backgrounds from any recent poor economic credit performance due to job loss, just please keep in mind that the history viewed on credit applicants can be 1 year if they only have a short credit report, short lending history or young of age, to 20, 30 years if they have positive financial information in which to look at. So that full picture is going to be looked at by employers, not just 1 year of poor economic performance. So what I would say in my last remark is, given that existing federal laws regulate the use of credit reports and have now for 40 years in employment, and already provide significant protections to individuals in Oregon as well as others around the country, and create significant potential liabilities for businesses that use credit reports, I feel at this point it's unwise for this committee to hastily move to impose further restrictions on the use of credit reports by employers. And I'm happy to be further service to the committee by answering questions or providing further testimony. Thank you very much.
Great. I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from the whole panel.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Members, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I'm not going to comment on the bill. It hasn't undergone proper vetting and analysis by our shop, but we have been trying to build our reservoir of knowledge on how employers use credit reports. And I would just say briefly, there are some legitimate purposes served by an employer having some access to this information. The first of which is to insulate the employer itself from employee fraud. As it was alluded to before, most of the companies, and I would say just about all of them, have kind of used this position of trust threshold for which these types of reports are commonly used. People that have access to company resources, people that have access to customer information. And it's also used as a shield for liability, especially as it relates to their employees having access to the assets and information of customers. A home health care worker comes to mind. It's just to highlight that there are some legitimate issues for which an employer might need this type of information. I don't know if that's preserved in this bill or not. I can't make that judgment call. But I would like the committee to keep those types of things in mind when evaluating this issue.
Okay, thank you for those comments, and I fully appreciate that you didn't see this bill draft until probably an hour or so ago because it wasn't available until then. So we weren't expecting you to respond or anybody else to really respond. Questions from committee members, Senator George.
Eric, thanks for coming today, and I want to ask you a quick question on how the credit reporting agencies actually interact with employers on this. As I understand, every time a consumer makes a credit application, it goes on their credit report as an inquiry.
That's correct.
And that can affect the score, the FICO score, whatever score, the Isaac score, whatever they you all use. If I'm by trade, I'm a bank teller, and I go to three credit unions and three banks that are federally insured, and I get interviewed and I fill out do credit applications, are those the type of inquiries that would change the credit score of the applicant?
No. First of all, let me sort of...
Is it just a credit inquiry?
Let me clarify that. Okay. There's no such thing as a credit score in employment. So a credit score is used for what I would say large transactions. It's a credit score is a snapshot of a credit report that's used and was developed for the mortgage industry and others who need to process maybe tens of thousands or a million applicants a day. So, and it's supposed to keep the system really objective, and so that you're not looking at the details of a credit report. But there's no such thing as there's no score that's used in employment decisioning. The second thing to say is that inquiries in and of themselves are not available, not used in employment decisioning as well. So when you're shopping around for a mortgage or that sort of information, that's not going to be normally part of the decision. When you're going, let's say you're reviewing your own credit report or you're shopping around, that information will be potentially visible to you, but it's not going to be part of an employment report.
Madam Chair, I think Eric misunderstanding what I'm asking. Let's say, for instance, I moved to Portland from St. Louis.
Sure.
And I'm looking for a home, so I'm but first I'm looking for a job. So I go to six different banks and ask for a teller position, and they all make inquiries to the credit reporting bureau. Okay? They all say, hey, all of a sudden this person has a lot of activity on their credit report because a lot of employers are asking information.
Right.
Do those inquiries have any potential for negatively impacting the consumer?
No, because they're only visible to you as a consumer. When you make an inquiry for a few things, if you say you review your own credit report, or when an employer makes an inquiry for a job applicant, or when there's an inquiry for insurance purposes, that information is what's called a soft inquiry, and that is only visible to you, the consumer, and never visible to anyone else who's pulling the credit report, so it couldn't be used in any sort of decisioning.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
So I had a couple of questions, and Eric, I want to thank you for coming here once again because I know that you live in Chicago, so you're obviously traveling some distance and spending money in our state while you're here, which the state really needs with our economy and 11%+ unemployment. So we appreciate that, too.
And it's warmer here.
Most definitely.
So
no snow to shovel.
So a couple of things about how this all works, because obviously you're one of the national experts. So when employers do access this information, My understanding is it's sometimes done as part of a bundling of products that your company or other companies provide to employers. Can you describe a little bit about how that would work? Say I had a business and I wanted to interview maybe, you know, 100 people, because we know the ratio of people applying for some good jobs can be that high for one job. How would I go about getting the information?
Yeah, let's say you have a mass of potential folks you're going to hire. I mean, let's say you have 1,000 job applicants. Typically, our customers are only going to pull what I'd say the employment screening report on when you're doing the final screening. You're not doing it en masse because, as I mentioned in my testimony, it's just too costly. You know, it's going to ring up the tab to screen everybody, and it's not meaningful because, you know, the time involved to screen all those folks and look through credit reports and et cetera, it's just so you're going to do it on the final two or three that you might hire, and you're going to be looking at apples and apples at that point. And you're trying to determine who is the best qualified, who is the lowest risk for your business as well. So what we typically do, and we work through resellers as well, so those third parties who resell credit reports, the local credit bureaus and mortgage companies and banks, I mean, are what we say resellers. But the local screening companies will typically buy maybe a criminal background history report. So part of our reports, it's not part of the credit report, but we also provide criminal background histories. We can do employment verification checks. We can do checks on income. There's a suite of products depending upon what that individual company wants to screen for. We can do it. We do background checks on, or to check on education, for example. So all of those are background checks that we'll bundle up and provide as part of a package to businesses. And I said that mostly it's only to the final few applicants for any position.
And I'm not going to ask you statistics because I don't know if you have them for Oregon about the volume of business, and I'm not going to ask you to violate any proprietary information. But when we hear these national statistics that seem to vary, you know, from the Society of Human Resource Management, we hear 60% of employers are doing the credit history and accessing the credit history. Does that seem like a reasonably accurate ballpark figure?
Yeah, I think so. 60% of employers are screening, but they're not screening for every job. They're certainly not screening for every position, and they're not screening every applicant. That would just be, you know, untenable, unfeasible for all jobs. So I think the 60% number, 60% of Oregon businesses do, and in general, which means that the bank, you know, Citibank, which might have tens of thousands, or Walmart, which has 1.3 million individuals, is certainly screening, but they're not screening all jobs. They're not screening all parts. So yeah, it's pretty consistent with what we know as well.
And you talked a little bit about these adverse action notices that people receive if you're applying for a car loan, obviously you know that they're accessing your credit. You give permission for that. And when the loan is denied, though it's never happened to me personally, it's happened to friends, you do get notified. But do you know, sort of out of this 60% of employers, how common is it for somebody not to be hired and receive an official adverse action notice?
Sure. Well, if let's say that for every, if there's only one job applicant and you hire that individual, when you have a credit report and you're using that credit report as part of the screening, you don't have to provide an adverse action. But if you have three individuals and you only hire one, then you have to provide two adverse action notices, both those individuals who you've screened and used credit reports for. So every individual who, if you're screening for a job and you pull 100 credit reports but you only hire one, then you're going to have to issue 99 adverse action letters, regardless of whether the information contained in the credit report had any relevancy to that job, because that's the only requirement under the federal law for providing adverse action. You don't have to provide it because the person smelled bad or you know, had a lack of education or didn't meet other job requirements, but because there's such stringent notification based upon the use of the credit report, that individual is automatically going to get an adverse action letter regardless of whether credit played as a factor. Just as if they used it and they were denied that employment.
So when employers are accessing your products, do you provide the adverse action notice as part of the package that you're selling them?
No, that must be generated by the employer. And what we do is we then fulfill the adverse action notice will say that you have the right to what the reasons were that you were denied, who the reporting agency was that generated that information, and in the credit report, how to get a free copy of the credit report. So we have to fulfill all of that, and we're often called upon that to give the reasons why, but of course the employer is the only one, because what companies like TransUnion do, and we're objective facilitators, we provide solely objective information, factual information about that prospect, and it's really, we don't make any decisions, so we wouldn't have any of that information.
And finally, just wanted to ask you about a couple of other things that you said. So that you cited that $650 billion annual losses, I think you said, for the most recent year, which didn't include Bernie Madoff. I think really one of the cruxes of the debate about whether this information is relevant is what its predictive value really is to prevent things like that from happening. I would assume most people would agree if we had seen Bernie Madoff's credit history, we probably wouldn't see that he had a lot of debts before this all came to light in the newspaper. Right. So what is your evidence? I mean, you obviously can send us these studies, but what is the evidence that there's a strong correlation between accessing an applicant's credit history and eventual problems of loss to the employer or to the clients, I guess, in that case?
I would say that there, at this point, we don't have any research to show any statistical correlation between what's in somebody's credit report and their job performance or their likelihood to commit fraud. Say that's really up to the employer to determine each and every time whether that job applicant, whether the standards that they're set for that job, whether there might be something in the credit report that might set up a red flag. And so it's really on a case-by-case basis that the individual's credit report is in balance with the job requirements. If there's high outstanding debt, sure, that doesn't mean that correlates to somebody to fraud. But given all things equal between two or three job applicants, if a person has a high amount of debt versus somebody who doesn't, and all things other being equal, well, maybe they want to consider that in their lack of paying those debts off, what that means. And we don't make those decisions, so I really couldn't comment that further.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Okay, well, thank you once again for traveling so far in jail. Just because you didn't travel so far, we still really appreciate you being here. I know how busy you are.
Thank you. I'm available for further questions if you have any.
Thank you both. And then it looks like we have two more witnesses, and they are Angela Martin and Stacey Howard. So if you could please come forward. Welcome to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your patience.
I think that Angela's going to go after me this morning. My name is Stacey Howard, and I'm the Homeownership Director for the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation with offices in Lane and Marion Counties. We are a nonprofit, and among our other activities, we are a HUD-certified housing counseling organization. We work with people both in pre-purchase and in foreclosure work. And so we use credit reports extensively in our work. And on the pre-purchase side, one of the things that we're doing is to help people correct problems in their credit reports. And I have been to quite a few trainings around the issue of credit reports, most recently a training about 8 months ago with Credco, who is who we purchase our credit reports from, and they are, I don't know how you describe them, but they merge all the information from TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian into a tri-merge report that then we access to, on the one hand, to assess a person's readiness to purchase a home, and on the other hand, to verify information that we're given in our foreclosure prevention work. According to Credco, 50 to 55% of all credit reports that they issue contain errors of some type, and we didn't go into at that point what types of errors those were. However, I can say that in the work that I do, the errors can be significant in that when there is misinformation, regardless of the type of information, it takes an average of 3 to 6 months for our clients to correct that information. So regardless of whether they're showing an account that may even be positively impacting their credit, or account that is negative impacting their credit, you're still looking at quite a long period of time before they're able to get that information that's erroneous removed from their report. In the foreclosure work that we do, we are using the reports to verify information given to us by our clients. And here's what I would say. Most of the people that come to us, by the time they are at the point of contemplating losing their homes or trying to modify a loan, they've often had some pretty extensive damage done to their credit. Let me tell you who my clients are. They're engineers. They're architects. They're mortgage brokers. They're realtors. They're contractors. They are RNs. I haven't had a doctor yet. I've had many, many business owners, small business owners. I've had mill workers, tree planters. Foreclosure is non-discriminatory, and it impacts everyone in the community. But many of the people that I work with, most of the people that I work with, were not low income at the time that they got the home loan that is now in trouble. Therefore, they are more likely to be in the types of jobs where they have to have their credit checked in order to become reemployed. And since most of these people have either suffered a job loss or have had their commission-based salary severely cut, or you know, their small business income severely cut, they often have debt loads that are much higher than their current capacity to pay. These are people who... Okay, let me step back. Most of the people I work with, regardless of income level, prefer to pay their bills and prefer to save their credit. It is often a period of many months before they come to the realization, I have hit bottom. There's nothing more I can do. So that pattern of non-payment of debt may appear to someone looking from the outside as irresponsible behavior, where during that period, there's no indication that that person was maybe in contact with that creditor every single month and was making every effort to pay on the bill or to at least pay some portion of that bill. Most of the people that I work with, I tell everyone that I work with, you probably should seek the advice of a bankruptcy attorney. I never tell people to file bankruptcy. I think it is not my place to do that. But I do tell them to seek the advice of a bankruptcy attorney because of the size of the consequence for the decisions that they make. They're very resistant, very, very resistant to that advice because people see the social stigma attached with non-payment of debt and with bankruptcy. They want to be responsible citizens. To have those same people go out and be screened out of employment because of something that may not have entirely been within their control and often was not. I also work with people in this work that have had cancer, strokes,
death of a breadwinner in the family. There are a lot of different circumstances that lead to financial problems. When Angela asked me to testify at this hearing, she asked me if I'd talk about my own personal experience, and at first I said probably not. And after I thought about it for a long time, I thought it's relevant, and some of us have to speak up. So what I can tell you is that I am a responsible professional in my industry, and I'm one of the experts in my field. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon and an MBA all but thesis from Northwest Christian College. I am intelligent, and I am one of the most honest people, according to my friends, that they've ever met, often to my detriment. I am also currently in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. I had a business with my husband that was related to the housing industry, and in late 2007, it became apparent that we were no longer a viable business, and our debt load was such that we filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. One of the reasons that our debt situation was the way that it was at that time was because of an ongoing illness that my husband suffers from that taxed our resources beyond our capacity to manage. I work 60 to 70 hours a week, and I always have, and I like to work. I have no problem with working hard. I have no problem with paying my debt. I reached the top of my professional ladder in my organization, and I've thought seriously about where I would like to move, and many of the industries that I would like to move to, I don't apply because I'm highly aware that they would check my credit report and that it would be used as a screening tool to keep me from being able to apply for those jobs. I highly object to characterizations of people like me that we are more likely to attempt fraud, theft, or to behave in an irresponsible manner. I think that my credit information is personal information, and it's only the business of people that I apply to for a loan because it is a predictor of my ability to repay debt. That is what a credit report should be used for. So statistically, there is a significant relationship between a person's past credit behavior and their future credit behavior, regardless of all other factors. And so in that situation, I do think it's relevant information, even though it impacts me in a highly negative way at this point in my life. I can't argue with it, but it does not predict my ability to function as a professional in my field. And it does definitely impact my ability to move either laterally or upwards in my chosen profession. And I work with a lot of people in the foreclosure prevention who are impacted in the same way. And I think that it's relevant that when we recently hired some new employees, we did not inform the other applicants that they were not selected for the position until we had an accepted letter of hire from the candidate that was successful. So people aren't going to know before. They're not going to be able to refute the information. By the time they find out that they weren't selected partially due to information in their credit report, it's a non-issue. And I would say that most of us will never file a complaint about this issue because, number one, by the time we find out, it's too late. And number two, it's personal information, and it is extremely hard to share, and it's not something that many of us are likely to try and bring to the forefront of any issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stacy. It's certainly not easy to tell a personal story like that, so I appreciate your professional background and also for your willingness to do that. And I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from Angela, too, so please go ahead.
Afternoon. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. One of the benefits of going last is that many of the people before me have made the fine points that are included in my written testimony, so I won't repeat myself there. I do want to say it is an honor for me to be back before your committee talking about issues that have been of serious concern to my organization for some time. It's It's obvious and well documented. The recession has stripped thousands of workers from jobs, forcing them to become late on their bills. My testimony includes many of the grim statistics. I'll let you review that. The fact of the matter is it's unfortunately a bad time to have poor credit if you're hunting for a job, because as we've heard, the incidence of pulling credit report is becoming more prevalent. Over the last decade, there has been a near doubling of credit checks by employers. This increased practice is supported by an increase in the development and marketing of employee screening products by credit reporting agencies. One of the things that we find troubling is the advertising, which promises that employee credit reports will help reduce employee theft, workplace violence, turnover, while also helping to improve productivity and honesty. As you heard in testimony today, there is a real lack of any evidence supporting a correlation between credit standing and workplace productivity or employee honesty. In perhaps one of the only published studies on the issue done by researchers out of Eastern Kentucky University, there was no correlation between a person's credit history and negative job performance. Again, negative credit information simply doesn't reflect a person's character or account for circumstances largely beyond their control. Opponents of state policies aimed at prohibiting pre-employment credit checks often claim that existing federal laws provide robust protections for job applicants. Unfortunately, this is simply not the case. First, it's important to note that no federal law or state law specifically prohibits discrimination on the basis of a bad credit report. In other words, it's legal to review the information and decide to make a hiring decision based on someone's credit standing. The Fair Credit Reporting Act establishes rules aimed at promoting two things, accuracy and access. However, those protections are simply not well-suited to today's fast-paced, competitive job market. We've heard what employers are required to do. What I'll report is that in my research on this issue, I got on the phone and interviewed employment attorneys across the state to ask about their experience. And the consensus was that they're simply not seeing letters of adverse action being sent to people who come to them with their suspicions that they were denied based on their credit report. So there is that to consider. However, even if we are to assume that all employers were to follow the letter of the law simply does not provide individuals with the type of time-sensitive protection necessary to correct an error and be considered for a particular position. You heard Stacey Howard's testimony that in working with her clients, errors can take 3 to 4 months. Even on the short window of 30 days, that is simply too long in order to be considered for that position, because I want to note that there is no requirement that the employer hold the position open to allow the applicant the opportunity to reapply even if there were errors on their credit report. There is nothing that holds that position for reconsideration. Speaking to errors, we heard mention of a couple of studies. A 2004 study on rates of errors in credit report, and this study was done across 30 states, found error rates similar to those that we've heard quoted. 1 in 4 credit reports containing errors serious enough to trigger denial of credit or employment. Those errors include inaccurate public records like criminal records or tax liens, inaccurate payment information, and incomplete employment histories. One that stuck out for me when reviewing the report was that an attorney who participated in this study found, when she pulled her credit history, found that her last employer was listed as the employer she had in high school. The fact that she was currently a practicing and licensed attorney was simply missed on her credit report. Again, in an effort to do background research on this, I pulled my credit report and found that I was formerly a resident of South Dakota, a state I've never been to, and was happy to see that I caught an inaccurate negative payment information from a company that I had not done business with. So I got to explore the opportunity, how long it takes me to correct an error. I was quick. I called the company. I called the credit reporting agency, and it took me just over 3 weeks to correct my error. Additional thoughts that I want to leave you with. It's simply not the time for us to be denying jobs on factors that have nothing to do with the potential work performance, especially when those factors could be mistaken. We all know that now more than ever, with record unemployment and severe debt, Oregonians do need help getting back to work, and this is one way that our policymakers can remove a barrier while still protecting the very important tools that employers need to screen for honesty, potential fraud, and job skills. So I would urge the committee, as you can consider this legislation, to make sure that the laws stay open to employers for access to tools like criminal histories, employment credit checks, reference checks, but that we remove those barriers that have no proven correlation to my success or other success as an employee. With that, I'll close and accept any questions you might have.
Okay, questions for this panel of witnesses. Yes, Senator George.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming, Stacey. Angela, you made a comment here in the kind of closing minutes that we're talking about background checks generally. Mm-hmm. So what kind of things, here's what I see happening, is it's getting more and more restrictive on what employers can actually do as far as, you know, right now if you put out a job, you'll get hundreds of resumes. Mm-hmm. So you look at these resumes, okay, and of these piles of resumes, half of them could be completely fraudulent. And they could make up employers, they could make up previous jobs, you just don't know. So then you kind of work through, you do some checking. It seems like to me the problem is right now is that you could have people completely playing by the rules trying to get jobs. Okay, completely playing by the rules, not taking their resume and fluffing it up and doing all kinds of things, completely being honest. A person right next to them fluffs their resume completely, and they then come in for an interview. The person who's the totally, you know, upright, standing person who doesn't interview quite as well, so these are my two finalists, right? If I could pull a credit report, I'm just thinking that if I'm in a position, I could find out which one was telling me the truth, which one wasn't telling me the truth, and I could do those kind of things. I don't know any other way, I suppose, an employer could get that kind of information. I mean, it seems like to me it's be very, very difficult to get some of those informations. Right now, all of our employment attorneys tell us that if another employer calls on a former employee of mine, not to answer any questions. I'm not supposed to answer any questions because the liability that comes onto me if that other person doesn't get it, if my former employee doesn't get a job. So even if I have this glowing, great former employee, our policy in our office is not to say anything other than to confirm or deny whether or not they're there. So here's what's happening is, because of liability issues, the options for employers continue to get tighter and tighter on how you check background. And it seems like to me, the people who that hurts are the people who are taking their resume and are totally and completely honest and trustworthy. And the person who fluffs their resume, in essence, could get through the cracks because there is no way to double check that. So work with me a little bit here on how, you know, I'm open to this idea that there is discrimination, but I'm trying to figure out how you expect employers to actually confirm information in this environment of litigation where, as a former employer, I don't answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, it's always nice to be back before you and answering your question. Thank you very much for that question. What I see you're doing is properly identifying a concern that employers have. How do we assess the accuracy of the resume before us? What I'm suggesting with my testimony and with referencing research reports is that the tool that has been pitched and marketed to employers as the answer to that is not an effective tool. Again, I look to you and suggest the report that said the attorney who would have submitted a resume for the law firm that says, I'm an attorney, I have years of experience, if that employer were to pull her credit report it would show she was lying. The credit report is a tool to assess my ability to pay back a loan. It's not a truth-finding mission on my background. I mean, it's simply not built for that, and it hasn't served that purpose very well, and the errors that exist in it prove that. I would suggest and hope that our policymakers, when they craft this law, leave avenues open to be able to call former employers that are listed on the resume and do background do checks of verifying did they work for you. So the scenario you presented, if someone calls, asks if they work for me, all I do is say yes or no, that's all the credit report is doing, but it's not doing it very well. So I'm not certain that we get additional information from looking at that.
Follow up if I could.
Follow up.
I guess things what I'm trying to get at is that it's getting more, I'm just telling you, it is getting more difficult as an employer to hire people because of the fact that my options of doing background issues are getting tougher. Meaning, we do see quite a bit more fluffing of resumes than we've seen in the past. And all I'm saying is that it seems like to me that if we want the best and brightest to get the job, we need as many tools as possible. And it seems like to me the general rule would be is that of all the information I get a background check and I call references and I do these things, that a credit report would be within the portfolio of what I do to evaluate three different candidates. I mean, I think we'd all agree that the best thing for the Oregon economy is the best person to get a job. If there's three applicants, the absolute best person gets that job because they'll maximize the profitability of that company or that state agency or whatever. So my point to you is that what we're doing is we continue to narrow the resources that employers have to actually find out who the very best person is for the job in a totally fair environment. I'm not getting the impression that employers use the credit report as the only source of information. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. And so I'm trying to figure out the weights and bounds here. And if you could, there's this narrowing of options for employers. How would you say an employer kind of... It seems like to me we're taking away a pretty important tool for employers to be able to kind of in the portfolio of background information.
So I'll let you answer that, but I wanted to clarify one thing, that nothing in this proposed bill would limit the employer's ability to access employment history, criminal background history, anything but... except in these exceptional circumstances that are accepted in the bill, the credit, consumer credit history. So the kinds of information that I would think employers like you or me, if I was hiring somebody, want to know, we certainly don't want to hire people who lie, right? We don't want to hire people who are drug abusers. And we want to hire people who are competent to do the kinds of things that they say on their resume they can do. So to the extent that these kinds of reports are useful for, you know, showing that somebody didn't make up a college degree or didn't lie about their job history, if they're accurate, that still is perfectly allowable. I'm not sure how your history of debt actually shows where you have worked, whether you had a degree, unless you had college loans, I guess, that show up on there that are not paid. And even then, it doesn't really tell you whether you graduated. All that other information, though, is still obtainable from those sources. Nothing in this approach would prevent that. So I just wanted to clarify that, because I think it is, I mean, I'm sure it's a problem for particularly for small businesses who may not have the resources to actually go out and do what a very large employer does through their human resources department, which is just do their own independent checking.
I guess Madam Chair, you kind of hit an interesting point. I mean, this discussion has been fascinating because I've never really dealt with this issue, but it really is one of those things where large employers have full human resources departments where they have a much more thorough process, and so it seems like to me the companies that came up, they actually provide in essence a de facto human resources department that does a background check for you, and they provide these other options. So, you know, so you can see a full picture of different folks. And in essence, it seems like to me small and mid-sized employers who may use this, I'm trying to figure out how they would compete with somebody who has a professional human resources department that has hundreds of employees. And it almost seems like companies like TransUnion take that place at a lower cost for small and mid-sized employers. So I'm trying to get through my head. I can see the risk, but I'm also trying to figure out how do I weigh that against the overwhelming benefit of being able to have a full picture of three candidates and make sure that the person who's best qualified gets that job. And I guess that's the – I'm having a hard time getting the public purpose. I mean, is the public – is the downside so overwhelming that it overwhelms the good side of this particular procedures? And I'm not quite – that's what I'm trying to get at.
I think that if I can respond, my question to you would be, number one, do you have an accurate picture if there's such a prevalence of errors? Do you have an actual picture of the candidate? Number two, how do you know that the information is relevant? So, for example, the issue of debt. Is the debt too high for the salary? You don't know what other resources that person brings to bear for that debt. Do they have a trust fund? Do they have a spouse or a partner that has a high income? I mean, what other resources do they have? So is the information used in a meaningful manner? And I would suggest to you that probably in most cases not, because most people do not receive training. Most people that use this tool probably don't receive training in being able to really understand the tool and also in what is the prevalence of valid information in the tool. And I have to say, many of the mistakes that I see in a credit report are mistakes of address, are mistakes of position, of job, are mistakes of debt that doesn't belong to them, even though it's positive. If you've got $2,000 a month in positive debt on your credit report that's being paid on time every month, it still could look like you have a very unreasonable debt load for your salary scale. So, and those are common mistakes that I see, very common. So, I'm just, what good is information if it's not valid, and if you can't be assured that it's consistently valid?
Angela, did you have a comment?
Just briefly, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, those tools will still be available. We heard in testimony today from Mr. Rosenberg and others that TransUnion has a package of reports that you can purchase from them. Employment, criminal, I don't know if they do employment, but I've seen it made available, employment checks, criminal checks. Those will still be available. What we're suggesting is taken out of the picture is a snapshot of someone's credit debt history. But access to the rest of them, as you heard the chair explain, will still be available from purchase for small businesses from these large companies acting as a resource for these smaller businesses without HR departments.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay. And I think we're just about right on time. So unless there's somebody in the audience who has something compelling that cannot wait. And the committee administrator definitely has.
I just wanted to point for enter into the record written testimony from Representative Hoyle.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And so for those people who testified today who have written comments, and Mr. Rosenberg, I know you said that you would give us your written testimony. The committee administrator will contact the witnesses who testified and make their written testimony available not only to the committee members here today, but to our two committee members who were not able to be with us today. So we really appreciate everybody who traveled far or near to get here, and this discussion, I'm sure, will continue. So, members, this will be our last hearing before the February session, unless there's something I don't know now. So thank you very much for getting here. Senator George, you in particular, we're very excited to hear news. And
due day is one day from yesterday, so.
Wow.
But I got a funny feeling it's going to happen. A few more weeks.
Okay, so thank you very much, everybody, for being here, and
exactly.
We are adjourned.